From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 5th day of April, 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Greg Johnson from TGM. We'll explore BT resistance in the western and northern corn rootworms, and we'll take up the weather forecast with Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn settled today at 652 and three quarters. It was a penny lower. July down a half at 627 and a half. In December at $5.60 and three quarters a bushel, three quarters of a cent higher. May soybeans down 6.5 cents at $15.11. July 1477 and three quarters, a nickel lower. And November soybeans at $13.16, down 4 cents a bushel. Bean meal futures at 450.60, down $6.80. The bean oil at 55.22, 52 cents lower. Soft red winter wheat harvest month July, down 9.25 at $6.94 and 3/4 of a cent. And the hard red July at 8.61 and a half, 11 cents lower on the day. Live cattle futures at $160.30, 7.5 cents higher. Feeders at $202.10, they're 17.5 lower. And lean hogs down $1.20 at $88.37.5 per 100 pounds. Crude oil at $80.74, about 3 cents higher per barrel. U.S. diesel fuel or heating oil up 7 cents per gallon. And gasoline up 8 cents at $2.82. Greg Johnson now joins us from TGM. That's Total Grain Marketing here in Champaign County. Hi, Greg. Thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Well, what are you hearing from the TGM system about producers and whether they're, I know they're ready to go to the field. Has anybody really gotten a good start at all?
There's been a few isolated incidences, not really in our draw territory. Our draw territory is mainly down in that Effingham county area. That's Douglas County down there. And so it's been a lot wetter south. We've been very fortunate here in the central part of the state. We've not had the heavy rains, and I think we could be in the field next week if things hold true according to the forecast. But we have heard rumors that there are a little bit of beans going in the ground in Macon County and Sangamon County. That Decatur Springfield area, not a lot, just a few people trying it. And in fact, we heard our first one in Champaign County today. And again, one, not a lot, but people have put a little bit in the ground, but the forecast sounds a lot nicer for next week. So hopefully we can start seeing some progress next week.
And they'll go to the field. They won't worry too much about what they have in the bin. Is it is concerning old crop, both corn and soybeans? The last time we talked, you suggested that the inverses in the marketplace will give the off-farm storage a reason to move fairly quickly. Have we been seeing that over the last week or not?
We've been seeing movement, but we have not seen the inverses collapse. The inverses have gotten even more inverted, believe it or not. I think when we were talking last week, the May-July corn spread was 22 cents, and I'm just pulling up my chart here to see where we're at now. May-July corn now currently is at a 28-cent inverse, and on the soybeans, May-July beans were in that 23, 24-cent. Now they're up to 34-cent inverse. So the market is still trying to incent elevators and farmers to move the grain sooner rather than later. I think the expectation is that the Brazilian crop will hit the market. Our exports will start to dwindle a little bit, and so they want to sell it while the iron's hot, and trying to get farmers and elevators to move grain here in April, May, rather than wait till June, July.
Should they?
From a basis point of view, probably this is a good time to, it's hard to argue with basis levels, positive basis levels. I guess I could still see, until we see the movement, basis levels will probably tend to increase. From a flat price point of view, farmers probably need to be looking at these rallies and sell rallies. I still think we could be looking at lower prices come fall. So not to say that we can't go a little bit higher in the short run, but I think rallies should be rewarded. I think the bigger trend is lower rather than higher over time.
You've had a few days to think about what those numbers look like last week, both the prospective plantings and the grain stocks figures. We've talked a little bit about the grain stocks as it relates to the inverse, and you just hit on that prospective plantings number to begin with. It was a fairly large corn number, what, 92 million or something thereabouts for acreage. How concerning is it to you?
Well, it is concerning because the market isn't sending farmers to plant corn. The crop insurance favors corn. So the only question is, will the farmers in the Dakotas and Minnesota actually plant all the corn that they intend, that they said they intended to plant on the March 1 survey that was released on March 31? The weather would say probably not, but even in wet years like 2019, they planted corn up until the 10th, 12th of June, and they had a decent yield. It was very wet, a lot of drying charges involved, but I think farmers will try their best to try to get corn planted. And so all we can do at this point is keep an eye on the weather up north, especially to see if those acres get planted. But if they do, that 92 million acres at a normal yield of 180 bushels, trend line yield, that's probably going to lead to almost close to a 2 billion bushel carryout. And a 2 billion bushel carryout does not argue for $6 or $7 corn. It argues for probably something closer to $5 corn.
There was quite a streak of corn exports to China. I want to say 11 days in the month of March. Has that continued at all into April?
It has slowed down a little bit. There was an announcement this morning of both soybeans and corn exports. So we don't know whether that was China or not, but it looks like these higher prices, you know, corn has rallied quite a bit here in the last 3-4 weeks. So it looks like these higher prices may have tempered the export buying. We have not seen the export buying this week that we saw during the month of March. So we'll have to keep our fingers crossed and hope that there's some more export sales announcements to be made. But it has been very, you know, relatively slow this week.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Todd.
That's Greg Johnson. He is with TGM Total Grain Marketing. Last week, you may recall that I hosted a webinar related to BT resistance development in northern and western corn rootworm. This is the most damaging insect pest, or was the most damaging insect pest of corn until it began to be controlled by genetically modified crops. The corn root in particular was modified so that it would control the western corn rootworm that was beginning to lay its eggs in first-year corn. And now that insect pest, along with the northern corn rootworm, has begun to adapt to these BT technologies. At the end of the webinar last week, we took a few questions, and I'd like to play some of that for you now. Joe Spencer is with the University of Illinois and has been studying the Western for some time. I asked him just how widespread the developing BT resistance is in the Corn Belt.
Yeah, the problem with western corn rootworm resistance and northern corn rootworm resistance is widespread in the Corn Belt, especially the westerns. The northern range, the range of the northern corn rootworm is more in the upper parts of the Corn Belt, but resistance is a problem everywhere. It's probably worse in Iowa, certain areas further west. Wherever you have a lot more continuous corn, there's a lot of pressure on these traits. So resistance is a concern throughout the Corn Belt. It's something that is of universal concern among the companies, too.
Again, that's Joe Spencer. He's one of two entomologists from the University of Illinois that were on a webinar last week exploring BT resistance development in the western and northern corn rootworms. Nick Sider, who's the field crops extension entomologist, was leading that particular discussion. And one of the questions we got from those who were on the webinar included this one in Douglas County, just to the south of us, wondering what potential problems they might face this season and if it would be worthwhile to use a soil-applied insecticide.
I would say in Douglas County in particular, I'm not going to tell you it never happens down there over the last 2 years. I just haven't heard of it happening. You know, our populations in soybean right now are quite low. In my mind, the way I look at it, you know, when you're looking at rootworm control and if you need rootworm control for that larval population, if you're doing that after soybean and you're not in one of these areas where it's hardcore continuous corn, high populations everywhere, I'd want to do some trapping to see if you've got anything before I made that decision. Whereas if you're doing continuous corn, I think it's kind of the other thing. I want to do some trapping or some monitoring to verify that I don't need a control in that situation. Mm-hmm. But our populations in soybean right now in East Central Illinois, they're pretty doggone low for the most part. You want to verify that on your farm, but yeah, they're not a lot happening through most East Central Illinois.
Naturally, there was also a question at the end of the webinar about the potential for biologicals to control the western and the northern corn rootworm.
I haven't looked at the, I see it's New Leaf Symbiotics is what's in the chat box. I haven't looked at that one. There's a number of biological products that I've looked at over the years, and the results are in those published reports. We're looking at nematodes, of course, and our evaluation on those is kind of new. I would say we're not where we can draw a lot of conclusions on that yet.
At this point, I circled back and wondered whether there was a recommendation from the University of Illinois on how to control the western and the northern corn rootworm in areas that were having BT resistance issues.
I would say, I mean, the first step is to understand that population on your farm. If you've got a population, an economic population, there's a number of ways you can deal with it, especially if you're on the low to moderate side. You know, a soil insecticide on non-traded corn works pretty well. If you're in one of these extremely high populations, you know, that soil insecticide, it's going to kill rootworm beetles. It might not give you the control that a trait would, and certainly it's going to leave a lot more survivors. You know, and if you're in a situation where you're thinking about putting that insecticide on top of a trait, I guess the question I would ask you, it isn't so much, is that going to kill them? It is, you know, and that you could decide for yourself whether that's economic for you. The question in my mind is, you know, why don't you maybe think about something else to help reduce that population load? Because what happens when we continue with these traits on continuous corn for year after year after year, we just lose them. We just wreck them.
I then asked Nick Sider if his primary recommendation was simply rotation.
Yeah, that'd be the number one. The number one, I'd say, is find a way to get some rotation into that system. I know it's hard if you got livestock. You know, I know there's a lot of reasons we want that corn, but just in terms of leaving ourselves some tools in the toolbox in the future, there's got to be some crop rotation as part of that.
There are two more questions yet to answer. Somebody would like to know if there's any risk of cross resistance with above and below ground traits. So I'm meaning soil insecticides and or the genetic modifications.
I don't think there's a risk of cross resistance because the way they act is so different. Mm-hmm. What you do have the risk of course, is there's a risk of resistance to the traits. Obviously, we've talked a lot about that. And there's a risk of resistance to those soil insecticides as well. They've seen some of that out in Nebraska to the pyrethroid insecticides. We haven't seen it here to really any of our currently available insecticides. We saw it to like cyclodienes and like older school chemicals in the past. One thing our insecticides do that's a little bit, you know, one of the disadvantages, they leave a lot of survivors, right? They leave a lot of adults behind. Well, that is kind of a natural refuge in some ways, because the reason they're doing that is they don't control those larvae through the entire root mass. They don't get to the outside of the root mass very well. And so that's one of the thoughts on why we've been able to maintain susceptibility to those for so long. But of course, that also means they're not an effective population suppression tool the way an effective BT trait is.
That's Nick Sider. He's the field crops extension entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. He was also joined on last week's webinar that highlighted BT resistance in western and northern corn rootworms, especially north of Interstate 80 in the state of Illinois, and other parts of the Corn Belt by Joe Spencer, who is with the Illinois Natural History Survey and has been studying as an entomologist just the Western corn rootworm and its adaption to different control methods. If you'd like to see the whole of this webinar, you can do that right now. It's up on our website, willag.org. Look for the link. And once that comes down, it's always in the Farm Doc archive at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Look for webinars and then the archive, and you'll find the BT Resistance Management webinar. Let's check the weather forecast now with Drew Lerner. He's at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Hi, Drew. Thank you for being with us today.
You betcha. You betcha. So we got sunshine here. It's cooler, though. It was really hot earlier this week, so a little bit of change. Typical spring weather, right?
Yeah. Grass is green. That's good. Speaking of spring weather, I'd like to start in the plains, probably from south to north. Might be worthwhile to discover what's happening there. Can you begin with the hard red winter wheat growing regions, that Oklahoma, Kansas area?
You bet. Starting off the top of the heap there for the most recent couple of days, we've seen some wild extremes across in that region. Yesterday, we had 60 to 67 mile per hour wind gusts occurring from Texas into parts of Kansas. The humidity was 1 to 10%. During much of the afternoon, the temperatures were in the 80s. And if that's not stressful for an unirrigated crop that has limited moisture, I don't know what is. And then this morning, we turned around and dropped the temperatures down through the 20s across most of that region. So the stress continues. Of course, it hasn't rained significantly across some of the dry land areas in the West. We're still in a serious drought. And so the most important thing is it going to ever rain again? And today, some of the computer forecast models have been hinting at the prospects of getting a little bit of moisture in the second week of the two-week outlook. And, you know, when we released our April and May forecasts a week or so ago, we made mention in there that there should be an increase this month from an increase in precipitation from Texas into the eastern and central parts of Kansas and on into Missouri and Iowa. And I think that we're starting to see the models kind of hinting around that this is the direction we may go. Before you get too excited about drought and relief in hard red winter wheat country, it's important to note that most of the rain that's going to occur is going to still be east of the driest areas in the high plains. The high plains area will get some moisture in the second and third weeks of the forecast, but it doesn't look like a good drink of water to me for some of those folks. Now, central Kansas and central Oklahoma, that's a different story. I think they will get some precipitation periodically and will try to churn the crop a little bit and improve it just a bit. So the temperatures out there are going to continue to bounce around for a while, though. But next week's going to be very warm.
From those areas, let's go just one state north to Nebraska, where I made note during the USDA crop progress reports that Nebraska's subsoil moisture levels were just 22% adequate. Nothing in the category that was surplus. How are they doing?
Yeah, they're still limping along there. We did have a little bit of a snowstorm there a little bit earlier in late March, and some of that helped to get down into the soil when it melted. We do have a couple of weather systems that are going to occur again across Nebraska, but most of those are going to be in the second week of the forecast too. A little bit of light shower activity maybe initially here as we go into early to midweek next week. But I think for the most part, we're going to have to wait at least 7 to 10 days before we can get a better storm system to come into Nebraska. But Nebraska has a better prospect for that than Kansas, Western Kansas, and the Texas Panhandle. So the prospects are good that they'll get some moisture. But you're absolutely right. It's pretty dry out there, and a lot of folks are concerned about that.
Nebraska, the number three corn producing state in the nation. The number five is actually South Dakota. Can you go one more up for me? Are they in better condition?
South Dakota has got a lot of snow on the ground from the Missouri River Valley to the Minnesota border. Some of it's pretty deep, actually, when you get into the northeast part of the state. So, some of that area is going to have quite a bit of moisture to deal with. As you get closer to the Red River in the eastern parts of the state, The snow gets pretty deep, and so there's going to be quite a bit of runoff there. This last storm that just occurred, it was pretty impressive. I think Pierre, South Dakota, is right in the central part of the state of South Dakota, reported 14 inches of snow, and some of the areas off to the northeast saw anywhere from 6 to around 13 inches. I think there was one 15.6 inch amount up there. So there's some significant, and that's all fresh snow. It doesn't include what was already on the ground. In fact, as if we can just go ahead and look at the Red River Basin, that area has between 4 and 10 inches of water tied up in their snow across that region. Now, they've melted a tiny little bit of it, but a whole lot more is going to melt as we get into next week. Temperatures are going to get into the 40s and 50s in the afternoons. There will probably be a several-day period during the middle part of next week into the latter part of the week that will actually keep the temperatures above freezing at night. So some aggressive snow melt is likely to occur across some of that region. So unfortunately for some of that region, that means flooding. And so we'll be watching that real closely. We want to get the floodwaters out of the way pretty quickly so there's not any concern about prevent plant conditions.
That gets us through parts of North Dakota, some of Minnesota. As you go eastward into the southeastern part of Minnesota, parts of Iowa, Illinois, what do they look like?
Well, I think for right now, they don't look too bad, actually. We've had a good mix of weather across some of that region. It's been a little wet at times. What they really need right now is a warm-up. And presto change-o, that's what we're going to see happen next week. It's going to be much warmer throughout all of the Midwest next week. And also the precipitation pattern is going to ease up a little while. So some of these areas that have surplus moisture, not only in those states you mentioned, but even farther to the south and east, we are going to see the ground firm and soil temperatures rise, and we'll probably be in a better position to see some early season planting activity, especially in the lower parts of the Midwest, as we get out into the end of next week and on out into the middle of the month. So kind of looking up. Now, I will tell you this, there should be a ridge of high pressure that's responsible for all of this heat that's going to occur as we go forward into next week. That ridge will be in the plains initially, but it will drift eastward. And as it gets farther to the east, once it's over the eastern Midwest, which will probably be, oh, maybe in the second weekend of the two-week outlook, we'll start pumping moisture up out of the Gulf of Mexico. And that's one of the reasons why I think we'll see some moisture in parts of the eastern parts of hard ribbon or wheat country. And some of that moisture should come right up into the western Corn Belt too. So that's why I think when we get closer to mid-month, we're probably going to see rain falling across quite a few areas. So taking full advantage of the warmer and drier bias coming up next week would probably be advantageous.
How many open days do you think there will be after Easter?
Oh, I would say some parts of the Midwest will probably see 5 days, maybe six. It could get really good. And the main thing is that we're going to see temperatures getting into the 60s and 70s in some parts of the Midwest, and that's really going to help to accelerate the drying rates. So, yeah, I think there's going to be enough there for the areas that are not too terribly wet to really firm up and warm up. And it should be a good environment for getting out there and getting started in some of the fields.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City and helped us to wrap up this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.